This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast.
Hey, Tanya.
How you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for asking.
You're welcome.
How are you?
I am doing pretty good.
I hope all of our listeners are doing splendid.
Yes, welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back to another amazing episode of Crimes and Consequences.
Wow, you did that really good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This story is wild, not like any other story I've told you before.
Can't wait. Let's
start.
So you
ready? Yeah. Let's do it.
Do it.
In the fall of 1986... 15-year-old Warren was walking to school in Brevard County, Florida. Warren was a sophomore in high school, but was small for his age. He was only 4'10" and weighed just a little 85 pounds.
He was a sophomore?
Mm-hmm. He's tiny.
And he's 4'10"?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Maybe he hasn't hit his growth spurt yet.
Clearly. I hope not.
I hope not. During this fall morning, Warren walked by a truck in the parking lot of a bank near his school. The driver of the truck was a man named Mark Schwab, and he told Warren he was having some trouble starting his truck and asked if Warren could help him. Warren said sure, but noticed that the truck started really easily, despite the apparent problems Mark was having with it. Mark asked Warren where he was headed, and when he told Mark he was on his way to school, Mark said, "Well, I'll drop you off for the trouble of delaying his walk." Warren hopped in. And as soon as Mark drove the truck out of the parking lot, he grabbed Warren's hair, pulled Warren's head into his lap, and put a knife against his throat. Mark drove the truck down some winding dirt roads and eventually parked it so that a tree blocked the passenger door so Warren couldn't get out. With Warren trapped inside the truck, Mark ordered him to remove his shorts. He then began to masturbate Warren.
Oh,
I know. After a few minutes, he ordered Warren to masturbate himself, and he performed oral sex on Warren.
Gross.
I know.
Sick bastard.
I know, right? This poor child just wants to go to school. Mark's assault on Warren lasted about 30 to 45 minutes. After he was done, Mark drove Warren to the high school and threatened to kill him if he ever told anybody what happened. 2 days later, as Warren was again walking to school, Mark pulled up alongside him, gave him a $20 bill, and thanked him for not telling anyone.
The hell?
Mark didn't see Warren after that and didn't come forward about the crime that happened to him until 5 years later. The following summer, after Warren was assaulted, Mark, the driver of the truck, made a phone call to a 13-year-old boy's home whose name is Tahan. He told Tahan's family that he had adopted a dog that they had given up to a local pet shelter and that he needed some advice on how to care for the dog. Using that ruse, over the next few weeks, Mark visited Tahan's home in Brevard County several times, ingratiating himself to the family. About 3 weeks after first meeting Tahan, Mark called him one morning and told him that he had a house painting job in which he could use some help. Mark promised to give Tahan half of the $400 that he expected to be paid for this job. Tahan agreed, and a little while later, Mark picked him up. Instead of driving Tahan to the painting job, though, Mark took him back to his house. Immediately after the two walked inside Mark's house, Mark stuck a knife to Tahan's throat. Mark then forced him to take off his clothes, bound his hands behind his back with a cord, and blindfolded him. Mark touched Tahan's penis and orally molested him.
Oh, God.
Right. Mark then forced the 13-year-old boy to lie on his stomach on a couch, and that's when he anally raped him.
This makes me really upset.
Just makes you hate Mark.
Yeah, I do hate him.
He's disgusting.
Does he look disgusting?
Actually, no. Unfortunately.
Oh, that's disappointing.
He's kind of normal looking, right? Okay. Just like a normal guy. The entire ordeal lasted several hours, all morning and into the afternoon. Tahan blacked out during part of it. After Mark was finished, he untied Tahan, allowed him to get dressed, and drove him home. Mark told Tahan not to tell anyone, and he promised that he would put the $200 in Tahan's mailbox.
Well, isn't that so kind of him?
I know. I'll still give you the money. He said, "I'll give it to you tomorrow, as long as you stay quiet." Tahan had a small cut on his throat from the knife, and he had bruises on his arms from being tied up. He ended up going to the police and reporting what had happened to him. Mark was arrested and charged with sexual battery of a child. He confessed and pled guilty to the sexual battery charge, which had a possible 40-year sentence. At Mark's sentencing, he was sentenced to only 8 years in prison. Unfortunately and tragically, though, he didn't serve his full sentence or even half of it.
That's insane.
Right?
This is insane.
In early March of 91, Mark was released from prison in Florida. His early release wasn't because he had received any type of treatment or anything like for his sexual urges. You know,
rehab
how you can get,
or anything.
Yeah, you know how you can get counseling
therapy.
And everything? Because he didn't get any therapy. Although he had been tentatively accepted into a sex offender program for inmates, but before Mark could complete the screening process, that program was ended because of budget cuts.
Really?
Right.
That's not important in
budget
the budget?
Cuts? Honestly.
I'll pay a little more in my taxes for that.
For real. Still, even without treatment, though, Mark was released from prison and he was put on probation only 3 years after he was given that 8-year sentence. He was required to participate in a sexual offender therapy program as a condition of his probation. But in less than a month after his release and during the time he was participating in the program, Mark found another victim. Junie Rios Martinez was an 11-year-old boy who was 5 foot tall and weighed 76 pounds. He had won a kite flying contest, which led to his picture being published in the March 21st, 1991 edition of Florida Today, which was a local newspaper in Brevard County, Florida.
That's lovely.
Right? Because kids often get really excited to see their pictures in the newspaper, and Junie wasn't any different. He was really excited to see his photo in the newspaper. The day after Junie's photograph ran in the paper, his mother received a phone call from a man identifying himself as Malcolm Denmark, saying that he was from the newspaper. The man told Mrs. Rios Martinez that he had seen Junie's picture in the paper and wanted to interview Junie for another article. He called back later that day when Junie was at home and his mom allowed him to speak to Mr. Denmark. Junie agreed to be interviewed and his mother and the man arranged for it to take place at the Rios Martinez home before Junie's baseball game the following day.
Apparently kite flying is a big deal in
right?
Florida.
I know, right? Enough to write two articles about it.
I know.
The next day, which was Saturday, March 23rd, Mark Schwab, from our story, went to Junie's home for the interview and introduced himself as Mark Dean.
Where's Malcolm?
Well, Mark explained that Mr. Denmark, his associate from Florida Today, couldn't make the interview because of a conflict, but that Mark was prepared to conduct the interview for him. Mark carried a spiral notebook with him, with handwriting on several pages, which he said were questions that Mr. Denmark had prepared for the interview. During the interview, Mark sat on a couch in the living room. Junie sat across from him in a rocking chair, and Mrs. Rios Martinez was there. She sat on a couch just a few feet away. Mark asked Junie about the things he liked to do, his favorite subjects in school, his grades, whether there were any drugs in school or peer pressure, and about cars. Junie showed Mark his baseball and surfing trophies, and Mark told Mrs. Rios Martinez, "You must be very proud of him." He gave Junie a gift certificate to McDonald's, on which was written, "To Junie from Florida Today."
The newspaper.
The newspaper. After the interview was over, Mark told Mrs. Rios Martinez that he would like to interview Junie again for another potential national story, and that Junie should attend a photo shoot for the story at Florida Today's offices the next Monday. This is just snowballing, right?
People need a good story.
I guess, a feel-good story. Mrs. Rios Martinez agreed and told Mark that he could also take photos of Junie playing drums at a club where his father worked on Sundays. Mark asked Mrs. Rios Martinez if he could go with them to Junie's baseball game that evening, telling her that he wanted to see Junie playing and to get to know him and his family better.
Because that's not weird at all.
Right, that's not weird at all. Just some guy writing an article is just going to now hang out with your family. Mrs. Rios Martinez said, sure. And Mark spent a half an hour at Junie's baseball game that night. Mark didn't show up to the club to take photos of Junie the next Sunday where he was playing the drums with his dad at the club. Mark called Mrs. Rios Martinez that night and told her his deadline on the story had been extended and the photo shoot for the next day was canceled. The next day, Monday, he called again. This time, he told Mrs. Rios Martinez that he would no longer be involved in the article for Florida Today because he'd taken a new job with a surfing magazine. 2 days later, Mrs. Rios Martinez and her husband received a letter from Mark. In it, he told them that their family was a special one, unlike any he had ever met. and that he could tell all of the family members, Junie had two siblings, he could tell that they all loved each other very much. The following Sunday, which was Easter, Mark personally delivered an Easter card to the Rios Martinez family. Mrs. Rios Martinez was home alone. She and Mark discussed the letter he had sent to her and her husband.
She doesn't think this is weird at all?
Apparently not. She told him, quote, it had affected her deeply, emotionally, and that she was very affected and very moved by what he had written about her family, end quote. They also discussed the new job Mark claimed to have. He told Mrs. Rios Martinez that he had gained a lot of contacts with surfing companies and that he would like to help Junie get sponsored by one of them. Now, mind you, he's never seen Junie surf, but he does know Junie has received surfing trophies. So he must be good. He asked her to write up a resume for Junie and to get together some photos of him so he could talk to his contacts. And she did do this for him. 3 days later, Mark told Mrs. Rios Martinez that a surfing company was interested in sponsoring Junie. Later in the week, she put together more photos of Junie, and Mark came by the house and picked those up. He then told her that he wanted to take Junie to Daytona Beach to meet people from the surfing company over the weekend. That didn't happen, though, because the family wasn't able to make the necessary arrangements for it. But Mark was still determined. The following week, he dropped by the Rios Martinez household and told them that a surfing company, which he named, had agreed to sponsor Junie. He brought Junie a t-shirt with the company's logo.
Oh, he's going all out.
Oh, he is. He told Junie that he could have whatever surfboard he wanted and that he could even design the surfboard himself. Mark said the company would also provide Junie with surf clothing. He's laying it on thick.
Sounds legit.
It does. Over the next several days, Mark visited the family several times. He worked with Junie on designing his surfboard and clothes. He told Mrs. Rios Martinez that he had met with the president of the surfing company, and he hand-delivered to Mrs. Rios Martinez forged documents purporting to be the sponsorship letter and contracts. Mark provided the family with a list of the surfing tournaments that he claimed Junie would participate in.
Are surfing tournaments for 11-year-olds a big deal?
I didn't know that, but maybe.
I guess.
Maybe if you're really good. I don't know. I have no idea sitting here in Michigan, not near any ocean.
Yeah, I've never surfed in my life.
Me either.
It's better that way.
It really is.
No one wants to see our asses on a surfboard.
No, you don't. During one of his visits with them, Mark again asked Junie's parents if he could take Junie to Daytona Beach to meet with the surfing company. They agreed. Mark told them he would pick Junie up at 10 a.m. on Sunday, April 14th. That morning, however, he called and canceled the trip. Mr. and Mrs. Rios Martinez did not hear from him again, but Junie did. 4 days later, on April 18th, that began like any other school day for Junie. At about 7 a.m., he left his house for his sixth grade class at his middle school in Brevard County. He was really focused that day on the baseball game he was going to play that night. At about 2:15, a bookkeeper at Junie's school received a phone call from a man that said he was Junie's dad. The man told her to deliver a message to Junie. The message said that he would like Junie not to go home on the bus and that his dad would meet him at the ball field. Believing that the man was Junie's father, she contacted Junie's classroom and had him sent to the office where she gave him the message. Before I tell you what happens next to Junie, we're going to take a break.
So tell me what happens to Junie.
At about 3 p.m. that day, one of Junie's schoolmates walked with him to the short walk that it took to get to the baseball field. She saw Junie jump the fence to get into the baseball field. Another of Junie's friends later saw him, and there was some tall guy with him. They were getting out of a U-Haul truck. A short while later, the friend went back to the park, but the truck, the man, and Junie were gone.
A U-Haul truck.
A U-Haul truck. Junie's baseball game started at 6:30 that evening. Mrs. Rios Martinez went there right after work, arriving shortly after 7. Junie wasn't there. Her husband, who was also at the park, hadn't seen Junie. Mrs. Rios Martinez immediately left for home, but Junie wasn't there either. She called Mark at the number he'd given her, but she wasn't able to reach him.
Why'd she think Mark was going to be there?
I don't know. Or maybe she called him because she thought maybe he saw Junie. Later that evening, she and her husband reported Junie missing. Early the next morning, April 19th, Mark learned from his mother that a policeman had been to the apartment he shared with her and wanted to question him about a missing child.
So he lives with his mama?
Yes, he lives with his mom.
Of course he does.
About 45 minutes later, Mark wasn't home, so he called his mom and told her that he was going to see his probation officer. But he didn't do that. Instead, in the late afternoon of the next day, April 20th, he called his aunt, Mrs. Kinsey, in Port Washington, Ohio, which is about 1,000 miles from Cocoa, Florida, which is where Junie lives. Mark told his aunt that a man named Donald had forced him at gunpoint to kidnap a boy named Junie.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Mark said that Donald had threatened to kill his mother if he didn't kidnap Junie.
Because the guy can't kidnap a kid himself. He's got to force somebody to kidnap a kid for him.
For him. And Mark's just so good at it.
Like, why'd he pick Mark?
I know. Mark also told his aunt that Donald had forced him to have sexual relations with the young boy.
Mm, okay.
The day after that, April 21st, Mrs. Kinsey was visited by police officers who were looking for Mark in connection with Junie's disappearance. While they were at her home, Mark called. He called back later that day, and the officers were able to trace the call to a nearby town. So Mark went to Ohio, and that's where they arrested him while he was at a payphone still talking with his aunt. So they were able to trace it. The night he was arrested, Mark voluntarily gave a recorded statement to police. His story, as recounted in that statement, is as follows.
I'm sure there's a whole bunch of bullshit you're getting ready to tell me.
A whole bunch of bullshit. A man he identified as Donald confronted him outside of a bar about 2 a.m. on the Sunday before Junie disappeared, which was April 14th. And he threatened Mark and said, I'm going to get you sent back to jail. On Monday, April 15th, Mark received a call from Donald saying he was going to frame him for sexually assaulting a boy unless Mark bought a motorcycle for another man. Because of these two threats, Mark rented a U-Haul. He said he did it to make him look less conspicuous, and he checked himself into a motel in Cocoa Beach.
Why does a U-Haul make him less conspicuous?
You think he would stick out like a sore thumb with a U-Haul.
Yes, he would.
It is a lot more conspicuous than a motorcycle. Or a vehicle, right? According to Mark's story, on Thursday, April 18th, Donald found him at a restaurant near the motel and forced him into his car at gunpoint. Donald drove him to a field and threatened to kill his mother if Mark didn't do everything he was told. Donald then drove the two of them to a payphone that Donald used to call Junie's school, pretending to be Mr. Rios Martinez and leaving the message that Junie should go straight to the baseball field after school. After making that call, Donald took Mark back to the U-Haul truck and warned Mark that he had better return to his motel room with, quote, some kid, end quote, or else his mother was going to be dead.
This is so fucking stupid.
I know. I know. This is just dumb. Mark immediately went in his U-Haul truck and picked up Junie at the baseball field.
What? And of all the kids he decides to pick, he picks the one that he apparently adores and just loves the family.
And he just happened to know a kid, right? That quote Donald wanted. Mark claimed that shortly after he returned to his motel room with Junie, Donald entered the room, locked the door behind him, took his gun out, and told Mark, quote, now I got you, you son of a bitch, end quote.
Just stop.
Just dumb.
This is just so... How could he even tell the cops this with a straight face?
And they're going to be like, oh, yeah?
How's the cop? They'll just reach over and bitch slap him right
now.
Come on.
Stop the bullshit, man. Donald used duct tape to bind Junie's hands behind his back and a knife to cut Junie's clothes off of him.
Poor Junie.
I know. Donald told Mark that he was going to have to do something to this kid sexually. When Junie started to cry, Donald struck him a couple times and then taped his mouth shut. Donald then put his gun to the back of Mark's head and forced him to have anal sex with Junie.
This is very sad because I'm assuming everything he's saying Donald did.
He did. Yes.
To Junie, who trusted him.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the betrayal this poor child felt?
God.
Mark also told the officers that Donald forced him to leave the motel and told him not to come back for several hours. When Mark returned to the hotel room sooner than he should have, Donald ordered him to pick up and handle a black footlocker that was in the room. Donald again forced Mark to leave. After 5 or 6 hours, Mark came back to the motel room, but Donald and Junie were no longer there. Mark told the police he didn't know where Junie was. The officers extradited him back to Florida. While they were traveling from the airport to the police station when they landed in Florida, he told one of the officers that he wanted to look for Junie's body. For several hours during that afternoon and into the night, Mark directed the officers that were accompanying him.
I thought he didn't know where Junie's body is.
He's just going to look in random spots.
Look around.
Yes, he's going to help. He's going to look around. He's going to help. He took him to a bunch of places around Broward County. At about 10 p.m., Mark led the officers to a largely undeveloped part of the county. Once there, Mark walked down an unpaved road, stopped, began pacing around the road, and then pointed into the woods. The search team walked into the woods in the direction that Mark pointed. Not far from the road, they saw a small footlocker tied nearly shut with a rope and covered with palm fronds and debris, which obviously had been placed there to hide it. The lid of the footlocker was slightly open and a white cloth was visible inside. Even from 10 feet away, though, the team could tell from the smell that a human body was inside. It had been just 5 days since Junie was last seen. The officers took the footlocker to the medical examiner's office, where it was carefully opened. When the ropes tied around the footlocker were cut and the lid opened, there was a blanket that had several stains on it. Under the blanket was a small boy's naked body in a semi-fetal position. His face wasn't recognizable because of the decomposition, but through fingerprints, the body was later identified as that of Junie Rios Martinez. Also found inside the footlocker were a pair of shoes, socks, underwear, shorts, a shirt, a watch, a yellow medal, a gold chain, two towels, some pieces of wadded up duct tape, and a manila folder. Mrs. Rios Martinez identified the clothing and jewelry as items that belonged to Junie. Some of the clothing was clothing she had bought for him the prior Easter, and the gold chain was a family heirloom his father had passed on to Junie. An autopsy determined that Junie had died from mechanical asphyxiation, probably smothering or strangulation. In spite of the decomposition, signs of possible bruising around...
I already know what you're going to say.
Yes, that was detected.
Don't even need to say it. We all know.
Yes. One of the pieces of tape that had been wadded up in the footlocker had Mark Schwab's fingerprint on it. A search of Mark's car led to the discovery of a receipt from Kmart. The receipt dated April 18th, the day Junie was abducted, showed the purchase of a footlocker. After Junie's body was found, Mark gave another statement to officers. In it, he retold a story about a man named Donald.
Okay, stop now, for real.
I know.
How could he even do that? He pointed out where the body was.
Thank you. He said, though, this time he added that after he had raped Junie, Donald had forced him and Junie, who was still alive, to get into the U-Haul that Mark had rented. Donald drove them around various locations near Coco while discussing where he could dump Junie's body so that Mark would be blamed for his death. So he's explaining now, you know, all the places he took the police. One of the locations was near where Junie's body was found. Donald then returned Mark to the motel and told him to get lost and not come back for several hours. When he returned the next morning, Mark saw Donald carrying the black footlocker, which Donald handed to him. He then ordered Mark to leave. According to Mark's supplemental story, after he returned...
So what you're saying is a third version.
I know. After he returned to the motel a few hours later, Donald forced him into his car and drove him out where the footlocker was. He ordered Mark to walk into the woods where he spotted the footlocker. Donald then returned Mark to the motel and threatened him for the last time. The next day, Mark said, that is when he drove to Ohio to see his aunt. Obviously, Mark is arrested for this crime. During his trial, the trial judge, after hearing the evidence, because it was a bench trial, it was not a jury trial.
Because he'd have been fried with a jury trial.
The trial court judge completely rejected Mark's story about another man being involved, and he found that Mark acted alone. Surprise, surprise.
They never found Donald.
He decided that Mark had planned things so that Junie left the baseball field with him, thinking he was with a trusted friend. Once at the motel, Mark physically overpowered Junie. Mark bound Junie's hands with the duct tape, put duct tape over his mouth and part of his face. He determined that Mark took the knife and violently cut Junie's clothes off, leaving him naked, crying, and terrified. He decided that Mark punched Junie twice in the stomach. He put a bed sheet or mattress cover over Junie's head. And Junie was so scared that he was shaking. I don't know how the judge knew that, but he did. That's when Mark raped him. Junie didn't even have the solace of being unconscious and was completely conscious during this whole ordeal, which lasted, the judge said, a substantial amount of time. Junie cried throughout, stopping only when Mark finally strangled or smothered him to death. A few days before his brutal abuse of 11-year-old Junie, Mark had attended a group therapy session as part of the sexual offender program that was a condition of his probation. So it obviously wasn't helping.
Yeah, because it's very hard to rehabilitate
sexual predators, yes. On May 15th, 1991, Mark appeared in the state court at Broward County pleading not guilty to the charges of first-degree murder, kidnapping of a child under 13, and sexual assault of a child under 13. Prosecutors sought the death penalty. As I mentioned, he waived his right to a jury trial, and he was convicted on May 22, 1992. At trial, though, some witnesses testified that Mark was raped at gunpoint by a friend of his father's when he was a child. I don't know if that might have been like a mitigating factor.
Probably.
On July 1st, 1992, Mark was sentenced to death for the murder and given two life sentences for the kidnapping and sexual battery of Junie. In addition, his probation was revoked on the previous rape conviction.
Well, okay.
And he was resentenced to an additional life sentence, probably for breaking that probation, right? Giving him a total of three life sentences.
And death.
And death. The case led to the passage of the Junie Rios Martinez Jr. Act of 1992, which prohibited those convicted of sexual battery from receiving early release in the state of Florida. Mark's execution date was set for July 1st, 2008. On that day, when he was led to the death chamber, the curtains were open to reveal his witnesses. And Mark was laying on the table because the death penalty in Florida is lethal injection.
Old Sparky retired.
Yes, Old Sparky retired. Within 2 minutes of the first chemical being administered to him, Mark closed his eyes and his mouth opened slightly. The warden shook him, called his name, and ran his hands over Mark's eyelashes at 6:07, but there was no answer. Mark's execution was the first to test Florida's new lethal injection procedure, which was put in place when the execution of Angel Diaz was botched in December of 2006. Angel was set to die by lethal injection, but the needles that were injected into him, they were put into his muscle instead of his veins.
Oops.
Which caused burns and extreme pain, and his death took over 30 minutes.
How did they make that mistake?
I have no idea.
I mean, I always assumed an executioner was a trained professional.
At least get it in the vein. I always thought so too, but apparently no. Mark's execution lasted 12 minutes, and he was pronounced dead at 6:15 p.m. Junie's mother and father were among the 40 witnesses to Mark's death. And she said after Mark's death, quote, "I only wish my son had passed this peacefully," end quote. They wore t-shirts with Junie's picture on the front and the words, quote, "Justice delayed is justice denied," on the back. Outside the prison, the boy's other relatives clapped and cheered when they heard Mark had died. And just as a final note, you want to know what his last meal was?
Sure.
I don't know why I always find the last meal interesting.
I do too.
It was kind of boring though. My last meal would be fabulous.
Mine would be amazing.
His was 2 fried eggs, 4 strips of bacon, 2 sausage links, hash browns, buttered toast, and a quart of chocolate milk.
Sounds like what I had at Denny's last week. What is this?
I know. I'm like, really? That's your last meal?
Remember you were telling me a couple days ago about the one guy who ordered lobster?
Lobster tail and a half a pound of shrimp and some fried clams.
Now that's the way to do it.
Right?
Not number 4 in the breakfast menu at Denny's.
But anyway, that is my sad story of the death of Junie Rios Martinez.
Well, my mood went from chipper to down.
I'm sorry for that.
Well, since my chipper mood is ruined and this story is shorter than normal, we should add in that gruesome ditty I told you about last week.
Let's do it.
This is a historical story about a man that was skinned alive. And it's really graphic.
Oh, so a happy story.
My inspiration for this was when we did that live episode. Yeah, remember I told you I learned about being skinned alive?
Yes. Oh.
So here we go.
You came across this
one? Yes, I came across this.
Oh.
I didn't write this. This is actually written by S.C. Turnbow. This is a historical letter I found. So you ready? In the letter he says, "In the month of September 1859... I read an account in the Brother Jonathan, a weekly news and story. This is a story of a white man being flayed alive by a band of Indians on the Western Plains. In the year 1853, two parties of emigrants with the usual train of wagons and horses left North Arkansas for the state of California. When the emigrants organized, I was living in Huntsville in Madison County, where I joined one of the parties known as Captain Boyd's Train. A man of the name of John Mackins, formerly of Marion County, joined the other party. He was a large man, and he bore the name of being quite overbearing and disagreeable. When he left Marion County to join the emigrants, he was living in Flippin' Barrens, I don't know where that is, by some White River. There's two trains. They say trains, but they're really just groups of wagons in a row. The two trains, after starting, traveled together for a while, but finally they separated, about 10 miles apart. Before reaching the frontiers, Mankins made boasts that he would shoot the first of the Indian race he saw, be it man, woman, or child. The man repeated these threats so frequently that after arriving on the frontiers, the remainder of the party grew alarmed and tried to induce him to not kill any Indians for fear the remainder of the party would be massacred.
Yes, they're like, retribution,
dude.
Right?
Yeah, they're like, dude, please don't shoot any Indians. We don't all want to die. Being a long-headed and don't care sort of fella, he paid no attention to their advice. Arriving at an Indian reservation, and while passing on, they reach an encampment where there were only a few women and children at the camp. The warriors were away on a hunt. This gave the man an opportunity to carry out his threats and executed a squaw by shooting her.
Jeez, just for no reason.
No reason. He said he was gonna.
He said he was gonna.
The other emigrants deplored the cold-blooded, wicked act of the heartless man. They knew the tribe would avenge the death of the woman. They traveled on with the expectation of being attacked every hour. But they weren't molested until the fourth day after the woman was killed, when an emigrant saw a band of Indians coming in pursuit. They knew they were in trouble. The Indians were all mounted on ponies, and they numbered over 100. Each warrior was in full war paint.
Oh, that had to be terrifying.
Oh, my dude.
I didn't do anything.
I didn't do it. We hate him.
Yeah.
The emigrants were in a camp some 10 miles from the train, so they were actually about 10 miles away. The Indians came with a rush, and without making a halt to parley, surrounded the camp and demanded the murderer, or they would kill and scalp all the members of the train, including the women and children. I'd give them up. Here he is.
Here he is, that one, right there. Him. Do what you want. Here.
He's a pain in the ass anyway. The white men were all well-armed and had made preparations for this. They knew, again, that the whole party may be attacked. On the demand of the warriors, the leaders found that they were just too small in number to resist the enraged Indians, even if they wanted to. Mankins had committed such a wicked murder that they had no sympathy for him and handed him over to the Indians at once. Again, Here you go. The fury of the band rose to a high pitch, and they informed the white men that they were going to inflict one of the most painful tortures known to society. The prisoner knew he was doomed to a terrible fate, and the trembling, wretched man begged and implored the white men to save him from the vengeance of the red men. But his pleading was in vain. He brought it on himself, and he would have to pay the penalty that suited the desires and the thirst of the warriors. Are you ready for this?
Oh, yes.
The Indians took a stake rope off one of their ponies, about 60 feet long, that was made from rawhide, a buffalo, and they bound the man head and foot to one of the hind wheels of the wagon. The Indians did not delay much time in the preliminaries when they examined their knives to see that they had these keen edges. And the awful scene of the flaying of Mankins alive began. They began at the neck, and the man's blood was soon flowing little streams down his nude body, for they had stripped him of all his clothes before they tied him to that wheel.
So they had the people watch?
Yes.
Oy. Like they just couldn't move on? Like, here he is. Bye.
No.
Oh.
They slowly but surely took the skin from his entire body. Not in small bits or strips, but as a whole.
What?
The awful torture was done in the presence of the white men. Mankin struggled and screamed in agony. His suffering was terrible and miserable. He begged, prayed, and cursed. But the bloody work went on. The unbearable torture was continued. The man had cruelly murdered a poor defenseless Indian woman, and the tribe she belonged to were punishing him in the worst torture they could come up with. The exultant Indians finished their horrible and painful work and gave a yell of delight. Their victim was still alive, but was slowly becoming unconscious. They unbound him, and the bleeding, writhing form dropped to the ground where it lay quivering for an hour when death finally put an end to life and further cruelty by the Indians. Not an Indian left until they were satisfied he was dead. They then mounted their ponies with their war whoops and departed, carrying the human hide with them.
What?
Behind one on the horse.
Gross.
Soon after the yelling warriors had passed from their view, the emigrants dug a grave at the spot where the dead body of the man lay and gave it a decent burial. They marked the grave as well as the circumstances would it allow them. In an hour after the interment of Mankin's lifeless form, the party of white people took its departure from the place where the blood-curdling scene was enacted, leaving the new-made grave for the coyotes to howl over and the buffalo to trample on and the passing Indians to sneer at.
Damn.
That's the end.
Oh my God. Wow.
Live for an hour with no fucking skin.
Can you imagine? Any little blow of the wind had to be torture.
Yeah. It's kind of a strange story, and it was written so lovely. I had to share it.
But no, that's interesting, though. He kind of deserved it.
Skinned alive?
Yeah, well.
God, you're so heartless. So anyway.
Before we go, I would just like to remind everyone to subscribe or follow on whatever app you're listening to. If you would like further information about this episode or our other episodes, you can go to our website, tntcrimes.com. If you're interested in becoming a member and enjoy all the benefits of membership,
lots of great benefits.
Lots of them. Check it out either on our website or you can go to patreon.com/tntcrimes.
That's where you'll find our exclusive members only episodes where we have like over 50 that we swear a lot in.
And they're sometimes very gruesome.
Yes.
You can also find us on social media.
Yep.
We have a new handle at
Hardcore True Crime.
Hardcore True Crime.
I'm doing a Facebook and Instagram.
So check us out.
Check us out. Thank you guys for listening. We hope that you will listen to next week's episode, which you will get a notification of if you subscribe/followed us. And until then, have a great week.
And until our next episode,
don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.